Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Debtwire Municipals. Today's podcast title is Municipal Musings with Dora Lee. I'm joined by our reporter Kunal Kamal and Dora, director of research at Bellhaven Investments. We'll be discussing the current health of the muni market. Welcome back to the podcast, Kunal.
Hi, Paul, and welcome, Dora.
Hi.
Dora, we're excited to have you on here for the first time. Can you share a little bit about your background?
My journey in the muni industry right at the Great Recession was a great time to start, trial by fire. I first started at the rating agencies and then moved over to the buy side for a little bit. And then I moved over to the bond insurers to kind of get a taste of that. And I've been at Bellhaven now for 7 years.
So Dora, I'll start with the obvious. Historically, the muni market is seen as a stable environment. But now on a federal level, we are seeing several simultaneous policy and funding priority shifts, you know, like reducing FEMA assistance, tariff changes, MTA congestion pricing. Is the market factoring in these changes adequately? What is Bellhaven's investment strategy during this period of uncertainty?
Yeah, so starting with the pandemic, Bellhaven really sought to move up the credit curve and up the credit quality because I think the pandemic was really the start of, I would say, the great unknown. I had never managed credit or existed during a pandemic before. And I think a lot of other participants in the market have not. So we really wanted to, even within a very safe asset class, seek safety within one of the safest asset classes. And we've continued to hang out there for quite some time. And I think this has really benefited us with these additional changes with uncertain federal funding and uncertain economy. It's really impossible to tell the future. I don't think anyone has accurately predicted this certain environment. By moving up the credit curve and sticking with credits that have a lot of financial flexibility, they're most readily able to meet these rapid challenges and these rapid changes within the funding landscape.
There's also been speculation about, you know, eliminating or capping muni tax exemptions. How likely do you think this is to happen and what should investors watch out for?
The muni tax exemption has always been under attack. It's a perennial problem for the industry and the sector. The first big curtailment was with the 2017 tax reform bill. And I think that caught the industry by surprise a little bit. So we were really on guard and we continue to be during these current budget negotiations. We do expect the bulk of the tax exemption, namely for state and local governments, which is the majority of issuers, that to be kept intact. Where we see some potential risks for curtailment are for the ability of, say, private universities, higher ed, and possibly not-for-profit hospitals, some curtailment of their ability to issue. And we saw some curtailment within those areas in the 2017 bill. And we do, based off of current drafts, we do expect some kind of curtailment going forward. But it is also important that to note that so far, the proposals have been on a go-forward basis rather than on a retroactive basis, which should increase the desirability of those bonds that have already been issued.
So Dora, you've already said that you're not a mind reader and, you know, we're in an uncertain environment. So I put those qualifications there, but I'm going to ask you a mind reading question anyway, which is about the Trump administration's tariff policies, which seem to be evolving. And What are the immediate and long-term implications for municipal issuers linked to port activities, manufacturing, and cross-border commerce?
Yeah. You know, if I were a mind reader, I would be probably on a tropical island.
Right.
Yes. To be honest, the day I get those mind reading capabilities, I'm off. But I do think for ports and for economies that do rely on a significant trade activity, it's all about flexibility at the end of the day. So for example, for ports, we are looking at port credits and their contracts with various tenants, those long-term contracts and how they're what kind of cushion there are. Are there guarantee contracts that will insulate them from volatile import-export volumes? And then for the economies that do rely heavily on trade activity, what kind of reserves those governments have to weather a down economy or less volume? So the name of the game here is flexibility, flexibility, flexibility. The more options you have, the more tools you have available. to manage what kind of news events you're going to wake up to. And if this current tariff regime has taught us anything, is you can expect something in the morning and it can be completely changed by the afternoon and a completely different regime by the time you leave the office.
Right. And so, you know, with the mind reading thing, if I was a mind reader and I could pick the lotto tickets and I if just found out I won, I would walk up from the podcast right now and just leave you guys and just get on a plane and go somewhere. So I definitely get it. So another question along those lines in terms of like trying to think about the future, there are certain capital intensive or heavily capital intensive projects like California High Speed Rail, Brightline West. I think you can even say the MTA's congestion pricing plan, just in terms of they all require federal support for them to get off the ground. Mm-hmm. And in the past, we've seen that even when an administration changes, if it has that federal support initially, that usually continues. Now, it's not quite clear, particularly congestion pricing, that's an ongoing issue that they're discussing. Mm-hmm. And then with these high-speed rail projects, it's not quite clear what level of support the federal government is going to provide for it moving forward. Is there any concern from your perspective about federal support for projects like this?
There is. And I think that given the various projects, the level of political support and the level of controversies around those individual projects does play a big role in how the investor community perceives the risk of these projects. So taking each project individually, the California high-speed rail project, which is very different, I think, from the Brightline West project, growing up from California, is kind of like the Second Avenue subway of California. It's been going on for a long time. That has its own set of challenges. And I think it's more heavily dependent on continued government support as opposed to Brightline West, which while it does depend on federal support, the Brightline franchise has proven itself able to launch a service with a much lower level of government support as, say, some other high-speed rail projects. So there's a lot more depending on the project. The level of need for continuous federal support is very different, and each project itself has its own kind of little economy that they rely on.
So, Dora, I just wanted to talk about climate risk. Since the January Los Angeles wildfires, we have seen a series of negative outlooks and downgrades in utility muni credits, as well as city-backed credits for sewers and water bonds. What is driving these changes? And do you think the bond pricing is fully capturing climate exposure following the January wildfires?
The sector has been very slow and is still trying to wrap its head around how to put climate risk, incorporate climate risk adequately within its pricing models. And I think it's something that we'll see change over time. I think there are a lot of unique factors for municipals. One is that climate risk is a very long term and has a very long time horizon, whereas depending on where you play, you could talk about 1 year maturities to, you know, 30, 40, 50 year maturity. So it's very different. And then you also have the willingness of the government, either on the local, state, or federal level, to harden those assets in the future. So, for example, while there's a climate risk now that could pose serious dangers to a community, it's kind of hard to say whether or not there will be sufficient, how proactive the government will be in the next decade or so to harden those assets so that the next time it will maybe not be as damaging. But then on the other hand, given the nature of climate change, it's really hard to invest and fully protect yourself from climate risk all over the country. So you have fire risk in California, you have hurricane risk in Texas and Florida, you have drought risk in Colorado and Arizona. So wherever you go, you're going to have some exposure to climate risk. And again, it comes back to flexibility. How are you picking the credits that have the most flexibility to weather these storms, no pun intended? So it just comes down to, it's really hard to say, I'm not going to buy California paper because I don't want any wildfire risk. It's about being a little bit more nuanced and saying, what types of California credits do I think have the most flexibility to withstand a major wildfire event or a major drought event.
So the federal government has decided to stop tracking billion-dollar disasters. And I'm wondering from your perspective, how important is the loss of that historical data set in terms of investors trying to price muni bonds in terms of the risk adequately, in your opinion?
I think it is a loss to some degree, because the loss of any data is, you know, you just have one less piece of information. However, I think with, as we've seen with recent disasters, sometimes relying on multiple models, not just the data from the federal government, for example, data that insurance, property and casualty insurers use, has been more reliable and at predicting the damages from particular storms. And I think while the loss of the federal government data is very important, there have been data sets in the private arena that have really been developed over the past several decades that have really helped to enhance what the federal government data set has started.
And beyond climate risk, how concerned should muni investors be about rising cybersecurity threats such as ransomware on water systems? And are these risks disclosed adequately, and should spreads reflect more of this threat?
I think it's one of those threats, again, that it's hard to really capture because you can't really run away from it. And it's all about mitigating those risks by, again, identifying those credits that have that kind of flexibility. So ransomware attacks, unfortunately, can happen anytime, any place. I do not think that they have been adequately disclosed to the market in a timely manner. In those cases, analysts have really had to rely on tracking local and regional newspaper outlets rather than relying on market disclosures, which tend to only be disclosed after the fact, which is not very helpful, I would say. Again, it comes down to, are you investing in those credits that have the robust balance sheet to perhaps cover any delays in collections or any unexpected expenses that come out from these cybersecurity attacks?
Well, thanks, Dora and Kunal, for the great discussion on the health of the municipal market. Shout out to our podcast producer, Anthony Phillips, who always makes sure that our mics sound right. To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.